Hi, everyone. It's Janice, host of the Divorcing Religion podcast. Thanks for tuning into my show, whether you're joining me on audio or video. I've heard from some folks recently who have told me just how much the show has meant, and some of them have even found it not only to be life-changing, but life-saving, as they felt there was no one else who understood what they were going through, and they found the Divorcing Religion podcast, and they started feeling encouraged. Please help me keep my show on the air. Become a member. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Divorcing Religion podcast. I'm your host, Janice Selby. I'm a registered professional counselor and a religious recovery consultant. My guest today is Melanie Teresa King. Melanie is an associate professor of biology at Massasoit Community College, where she equips students with empowering critical thinking, information literacy, and science literacy skills. I found her through the fantastic thinkingispower.com website. Melanie loves to share her teach skills, not facts approach with other science educators and to help organizations meet their goals through better thinking. She's also the education director for the Mental Immunity Project and CIRCE, the Cognitive Immunology Research Collaborative, which aim to advance and apply the science of mental immunity to inoculate minds against misinformation. Boy, do we need some of that. That's so true. In addition to her Bachelor of Science in Biology and Chemistry and a Master of Arts in Ecology, Ms. Teresa King is a fellow of the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. Today, Melanie will be speaking with me about fine-tuning our critical thinking skills, including exploring how we form our beliefs. Welcome, Melanie. It's so nice to have you.
It's so nice to be here, and it's nice to meet you. Thank you.
I just was so tickled when I came across your website. So I think some of your posts have been popping up for me in Facebook, and then I kept clicking on them, and each one just seemed better and better about critical thinking. I think about logical fallacies and biases, cognitive biases that we have. Those were things that I never even considered when I was devoutly religious. I was a fundamentalist indoctrinated in childhood. And so I had a very set worldview and a very limited worldview. And it never really occurred to me that it might be valuable to question my beliefs and where they came from. So thank you for the work that you do.
Well, thank you. And it's good to hear that it reached you. That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I always share it when they show up in my feed. I like to share them because I have a lot of people who follow me who have also divorced religion or left religious fundamentalism. Typically, I start the podcast by asking people a little bit about their childhood, whether religion was a part of their home. And in your case, I'll ask, when did you start critically thinking?
Well, I'm still working on the thinking critically part, but I was raised in a religious fundamentalist community and household as well. And I remember asking questions and wondering, like, well, I don't know if that seems right. But in particular for me, there was very strong sexist positions that the church had taken and what the roles of women were. I mean, I was a little girl and I was taught that women were created to serve men and then were the cause of all sin in the world. And then women had to spend the rest of eternity atoning for that original sin. And yeah. And my mom kept telling me I could do anything a man could do. And I was very confused. Mm-hmm. When I went to college, actually, I wanted to be a veterinarian. And so I was majoring in biology and chemistry. I did go to vet school, but I decided that I did not. That was a wise decision to not stay there. But nevertheless, I studied science. And I actually didn't even really learn what I know today as critical thinking in my science classes. And it wasn't in my science classes that I was questioning my religious teachings. That was actually in World Civilization. I remember the professor talking about the ancient river civilizations and the different kinds of gods that they had and how they mirrored the kinds of environmental conditions in the different areas, and how they would create gods that were based on their environmental conditions and their needs and so on. And I remember sitting in the chair, like my memory is probably flawed, but I remember sitting in the chair in class going, whoa, wait a minute. God didn't create man. Man made God. And wow, did that make sense?
Wow. Ding, ding, ding. That is such a huge, shocking paradigm shift. When we encounter other people who are educated, you know, more educated than we are, we're there so that they can teach us things. And we have a level of trust for them as our teachers that they're going to be teaching us accurately. And then they expose us to this shocking notion that God didn't actually create man. Man created gods, many gods. And I'm sorry to say, you know, your own God is no different, is also a creation. And that can be really hard for people to wrap their minds about. What did you do with that new information? Did you share it with your family? Or were you just like, oh my gosh, I have to rethink everything I know?
You know, that was interesting. I don't know if I remember a lot of that. It was sort of a long off ramp for me then. Like, I remember having that realization and it making sense. And then I was in science classes. And so, like, especially that we were young earth creationists, but I was in biology. And so started questioning some of that. And then I ended up just rebelling. And And then I kind of remember losing my way a bit. I was trying to replace that belief with another supernatural one. And so I remember like exploring the ancient religions where God was a woman, for example, and the pagan traditions and so on. And then I was just making enough friends and questioning enough things that I felt a bit more comfortable. But actually, I didn't really learn critical thinking as I know it today until I was teaching. So I teach at a community college and I specialize in the non-major science education. When everybody who doesn't want to be a scientist when they grow up still has to take a science class, a science elective to graduate. And most of the time that class is intro bio. And I'm a biologist. I love biology. And I must have taught that course for like 10 years. I think I used between 6 and 8 different books, no book. I tried inquiry-based learning, problem-based learning. I tried issues-based approaches. So, you know, instead of just the cell cycle, how does the cell cycle help us understand cancer, right? And I was thinking that I was helping my students use what they were learning in a meaningful way. And finally, I had this realization that the students were just going to memorize everything that I was asking them to remember and regurgitate it on exam and then walk away and not only not remember it, my students were generally science phobic. They didn't want to take a science class. They were scared of taking science. And I was not helping. And so I just felt like I was doing them a disservice. And I went to the department and I said, you know, I think we need to have a conversation about why we teach gen ed science. And we all decided it's for science literacy, which is the next logical question. What is science literacy? And then are the classes that we're teaching those objectives? And I made the case that biology wasn't, and we removed it from the books. And I replaced it with a course that I call Science for Life, but it teaches skills, not facts. And the idea is it's critical thinking, information literacy, and science literacy. And I will tell you in the process of doing that, my overarching goal was if I had one semester to teach the average person what they needed to know about science, about evaluating claims, about using finding reliable evidence, thinking through that, what would that look like? And so I started from scratch. I looked all around to find what I could, and there were some people doing wonderful things, and they helped me along the way. And the end result was I learned what I did not know. Like, even as a science major and, you know, a master's in science, I learned that we don't even teach science majors these sort of basic understandings about how science works, let alone critical thinking. So then I thought, well, maybe people want to know. And so I started the website Thinking is Power, based on the idea that, I mean, we've all heard knowledge is power, but like we carry access to all of the world's information in our pockets.
Yes.
But also misinformation. So the question is, when you need information, can you find it? And can you use it to make reliable decisions? So I made the website and social media accounts, Thinking is Power.
Amazing. And so how long ago was that? When did you set up the website?
It was a pandemic project. So 2020.
Holy, and did we ever freaking need it? It's been because that's when, I mean, we've always had fringy ideas and elements, but holy cow, that pandemic just was an avalanche. People were dying under an avalanche of misinformation. Yeah. And I mean, it was just heartbreaking. And it was even hard to figure out how to talk to people. I mean, people that I had known as reasonable people and people who had been vaccinated as children, and they had vaccinated their own children. And then this idea that we might need to be vaccinated against this horrifying, terrifying virus that was killing people. And suddenly they didn't think vaccination was a good idea. And then trying to figure out how, without offending and alienating, how can I actually encourage people to consider getting this vaccine because it could save their life?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think back, I lose track of time. So I guess I can't remember exactly when I started teaching Science for Life. I want to say it was probably like 2018, 2019. So it was slightly before the pandemic. But at this point, I really worry about the science students that I had, the biology students before this class, because, you know, we had a new virus and we had a new vaccine. And we had conflicting, so do we wear masks? What kinds of masks? In what kinds of situations do we wear masks? And there were all kinds of, we were all learning in real time, right? We saw science play out in real time, and it's messy. And everybody got to see the sausage being made. And then they're like, wait a minute, I don't know if I trust this. But the problem is, so a lot of people don't understand how science works. And so they expect science to produce certainty and facts and proof. And that's not how it works. And I would argue that that's partly a result of teaching science like it's a bunch of things you need to remember, right? Because they think, well, this is facts. And I'm like, well, if you go to a science textbook from the 50s, a biology textbook, you're going to learn that our facts have changed. Even our facts change, right? All of it does. So we've taught science in a way that misleads people about the different kinds of evidence that we collect and what that evidence means and what kind of certainty we might expect. And then it was scary, right? We had a situation where people were really afraid. And when they're afraid, they need certainty more than ever. And they didn't have the answers that they were looking for from science. And so they retreated into their ideological bubbles, where they trusted those people in their bubbles, but they may not have been the most reliable source of knowledge.
Right.
And then once it's politicized, it's very hard to undo.
Yeah, politicized and religionized. Those two things got together, and it just made a difficult situation even worse. And because then we also were wearing masks, some of us, a lot of us, and then there was a visible alienator, a visible separator. Oh, you're one of them. You've bought into, you know, the government lie or whatever it is. And it just almost felt, I mean, on a much smaller level, but like a civil war, because people became very uncivil with each other. And I feel like even though the virus in some ways is in the rearview mirror, I know it's still around. I know there are still people being impacted by it. But those feelings haven't gone away. And I feel nervous. I feel apprehensive talking to people about these things because people take it very seriously. Their ideology and their identity become enmeshed with each other.
Yeah, that is a really important point. So even on, I was on team vaccine and team let's wear a mask because we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. But the problem is once you put us in teams, if there's an us, then there's a them. And with as much as I think that, I spent a lot of time on social media. And one of the things that was concerning me is people would post their, I posted myself getting a vaccine and so on. But then they would say, you know, I am vaccinated. And anytime we do that, anytime we signal those beliefs, then we're not just saying that's part of our identity. We're saying that's part of our brand. This is who I am. And as soon as something becomes attached to us that way, it's really hard to be objective about those beliefs. And it's really easy to other people who are doing something different.
That's so true. Yeah. Oh my gosh, that is very true. And I mean, even social media itself can be so unforgiving. Like it's a good servant, but a poor master. And during the time of COVID, people became even more deeply entrenched in social media because they couldn't get together with people in real life. So then social media kind of stepped in and filled that role. And there was such a proliferation of misinformation and finger pointing and name calling. And no, the government didn't get it right because the government hadn't really been through this before, at least not in kind of recent memory, not since we've had social media. I mean, polio was way, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, say, before we had social media. Do you know, through the years, as other illnesses have come up and vaccines have been invented, was there always a level of pushback against the vaccines? Because, of course, people are scared. I was scared when the COVID vaccine first came out. I did not want to be in the first six-month group that got it. I felt nervous about it. I thought, how can they possibly know?
Yeah. I mean, anti-vaccination attitudes are as old as vaccines. There was pushback against smallpox vaccines. There was pushback against, polio vaccines. It's scary, right? Putting an injection in our body is scary. And so I do think, look, I'm not an expert in the history of vaccinations. Mm-hmm. There always has been a certain element of anti-vaccine attitudes, but modern anti-vaccination attitudes really trace back to Andrew Wakefield. Mm-hmm. And the damage that's been done, for your viewers who might not be aware, so Andrew Wakefield in 98, published a study that linked the trivalent MMR vaccine to autism. Mm-hmm. And he told parents then to not give their kids the trivalent vaccine, but to instead give them individual vaccines and space them out. He held a press conference after his study was published in The Lancet, which is a very reputable journal. And at the time, right, autism rates were on the rise, or seemingly so. They were certainly being diagnosed more. It was in the public eye more, and people were concerned. They wanted to know what it was, and this was the first opportunity for an actual answer. So he published a study, and then other scientists, this is how this process of science works. Well, here's a credible hypothesis. Let's test it. And no one was able to replicate it. It's important to note that Wakefield's study had 12 kids. So he was a pediatric gastroenterologist. And what he did was kids that were coming to his clinic that were showing signs of developmental disabilities, he would ask their parents, when did they get vaccinated and when did they start to show symptoms of autism? And from this case study with 12 kids is where he made jump to his conclusion.
That's too small of a study, let me just say.
Well, it So case studies are useful for, again, the testable hypotheses, but certainly the conclusions that he drew and that he went public with were not warranted. But they weren't able to be replicated. And over the ensuing like 10 years, studies on millions of kids were done. And it was never, those findings weren't replicated. So a journalist went digging, and I do apologize, but I'm forgetting the name of the journalist right now. Wakefield is British, but I was a British journalist. And what he found was that Wakefield was trying to profit off of a an alternative vaccine, and that those 12 kids were not actually randomly selected. They were part of the litigants, and actually some of the data had been forged.
Wow.
So he committed the F word in science as a career killer, right? So he lost his medical license in the UK. The study was retracted. It took like 12 years, something like that, a very long time. Like the damage was done. Mm-hmm. Wakefield to this day still goes around the United States and Europe telling parents not to vaccinate their kids. Oh. He was part of the Vaxxed documentary with...
Right. We got the air quotes going there if you're just listening in. Documentary. No.
Robert De Niro. I mean, he pulls in Hollywood celebrities to help him spread this message. But our modern anti-vaccination attitudes can really be traced back to this single study with 12 kids that was fraudulent for him to make money. Mm-hmm. And it is just, honestly, in my mind, that is criminal. Mm-hmm. However, it is important to note that people who have fallen for that are victims of disinformation.
Yes.
And so everyone wants what's best for their kids. Parents who are choosing not to vaccinate their kids aren't doing so because they want to, you know, stick it to the libs, or they're, you know, don't like vaccinations. They just want what's best for their kids, and they have been conned.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And my concern right now is that we see measles is on the rise again. And we know the measles vaccine is very, very effective because for decades it's been effective at keeping measles largely at bay. And now as parents are refusing to vaccinate their kids against measles, now we see the rise. And it's a terrible illness. It can have very terrible consequences, and it's completely preventable.
With the vaccine. Yeah, I mean, vaccinations are in some fundamental way victims of their own success.
Yes.
What we've done is gotten to a point where we are so privileged in our ability to think that we can avoid these vaccinations, these diseases, that we've forgotten why we have the luxury of not having to deal with these illnesses.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. Gosh, that's that makes me think of being a therapist. Your ultimate goal is to work yourself out of a job, because your clients eventually get to the point where they feel strong enough to fly solo. But yes, so as far as vaccines go, that is that's an interesting thing to consider. So then can you talk a little bit about how our beliefs develop? So we know it's easy for us to become victims of misinformation, especially in a day and age when we're inundated with information, because it's on it's on our computer, it's on our phone, it's on the TV, it's everywhere. And most of us maybe don't quite know how to ferret through and determine what's factual and what's fiction.
Yeah, this is a really good question. So I think we should start with what a belief is.
Yeah.
So a belief is anything you think is true. There are lots of different definitions for it, but I think this one is the simplest and most useful. It doesn't have to be true. You could have good reasons for it or not, but it doesn't matter. If it's something that you accept as true, then it is one of your beliefs. We act on our beliefs. Right. So it's important to note that our beliefs form the basis of how we think the world works. And that's then what we use to make decisions. And we like to think of ourselves as really rational people.
Open-minded.
Right?
Yep.
Well, I mean, look, my beliefs are all evidence-based. I know they're actually true. Like, I wouldn't believe in things that aren't true, right? And I believe in things that are true because I have followed the evidence like a critical thinker would. And for all of that is rubbish. That's not how most of it works. Most of the time, what happens is we form beliefs through either our personal experiences or through received wisdom. Both of those are flawed, right? But I could say, I know ghosts are real because I saw one. Right. I have a ghost story, right? I could tell you I know ghosts are real because I saw one. I know now it wasn't a ghost. I could say, I know homeopathy works because I tried it and I felt better. Or I could say, well, I have heard that vaccines cause autism, right? So all of these are coming from either my experiences or people that I trust. And so all of that swims like in a background of trust. Have you heard the phrase post-truth?
Oh, I think so.
I think it was one of the words of the year, like in the mid-teens. So it's this idea that Americans are kind of past even caring what truth is. It was around those same time as like alternative facts and whatever. Like, we're in a post-truth society. Nobody really even cares what's true anymore. I actually disagree with that. I think that we actually do care what's true. Like, none of us are going to say, yeah, I believe in things that are completely crap. They're going to say, well, my beliefs are true. You're wrong, of course, if you disagree with me. I would say it's more post-trust than post-truth, in that what's happened is we have gone further and further into our ideological bunkers where people tell us, confirm to us what we already think about the world is true. They all believe the same core beliefs that we do. They're on our team. The other is the one that's wrong. And so we think we believe in what's true, but actually what we're doing is we're trusting sources that don't necessarily deserve our trust. And importantly, we've lost trust in reliable sources. And that is not by accident. In that, if disinformation purveyors, so misinformation is things that aren't, that are misleading, that are wrong. Disinformation is purposefully deceitful. So it's a type of misinformation. But if I want to convince you of my narrative of disinformation, I actually don't need to do that. I don't need to convince you that all the scientists are wrong. I just need to convince you that they don't actually know enough. I just need to sow enough doubt to get you to question it and then tell you, well, they're just out for power or control or whatever, these conspiratorial narratives. And all of that just throws in enough shade that we kind of go, I don't know what to believe. I'm just going to trust people that are on my team.
Wow. It sounds like defense lawyers, or it sounds like lawyers. Oh my gosh. Wow. Oh, what can we do? So what happens then? I mean, if people just kind of have to sow enough doubt, how do we determine who is a trustworthy and credible source for information?
Yeah, I honestly think this is one of the bigger problems we face. Like, if we disagree on the facts or the evidence, we can have a conversation over that. Right. I can show you my evidence. You can show me yours. And hopefully we can work together to try to sort it out. But what disinformation is doing is breaking apart the fabric of trust. Trust in reliable sources of knowledge production, things like scientific communities or evidence-based journalism or government agencies. Right. These are all human institutions, and there can be people within them that don't play by the rules and are out for their own personal gain. But all these systems are also set up to have checks and balances. So ultimately, the process itself is what's trustworthy, the overall community, not individuals within it. So that disinformation has to convince you not to trust that. And once that trust is broken down, it's really hard to get back. Like, again, we could talk about our facts, but trying to get you to trust me again is a different beast altogether. And I wish I could solve this problem. I really don't. I don't know what the answer is. I know that for myself, like, I'm an educator. I have no sway over how government agencies regulate various forms of disinformation. I don't have any sway over like Meta and how it tries to sort through misinformation. I've got lots of Meta stories, and they try supposedly, but they don't do a very good job. Or any of these big systemic issues. All I've got is trying to help the end user in this system try to think better for themselves so that they don't get fooled.
Right, right. And where the distrust or the erosion of trust really comes into play with my demographic, people recovering from religious trauma, I see people who no longer trust doctors, trust science, and if they are deeply religious, they are now feeling the only person, the only one who can save them is a strong man. They have to then set up a strong man. We, you know, they're not even interested in democracy anymore. We want a ruler. We want a dictator. We want someone who's strong because we think that's going to keep us safe. That is terrifying to me. And I don't know how to get through to those folks. And those aren't the people I work with. I work with their children and grandchildren who have left, but who are very concerned and see their families fracturing and splintering apart and wondering how can they even keep communicating. And you touched earlier on kind of things that we have in common. So every parent wants their child to be safe. That's like the basic desire and hope that we have. And so that's what I tell my clients. When our beliefs are no longer the same, we have to pivot and look at the values, shared values, and try and focus on that. Is there any way that you can maintain still talking with your parents and grandparents if you're talking about the grandkids, because they love the grandkids? And sometimes that's not possible because the conversation will be hijacked again and again. If the people are fundamentalists, that's their most important thing, is that everybody has to believe the same way they do. So there's not an easy fix. Is there a way that we can kind of protect ourselves? Like, what's the best way that we can protect ourselves against misinformation?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. There's a lot in there, and there's some sad things in there too. And a lot that I relate to. Protecting ourselves against misinformation, I think, starts with, we need to understand why we fall for misinformation. All of us can be fooled by misinformation. It's just that we're vulnerable to different kinds of misinformation. So the three biggest reasons that we fall for misinformation are when it confirms our biases. So if it supports how we already think the world works, then why would we question it, right? I mean, that makes sense. And honestly, questioning is harder than accepting. The mental pathways that go, wait, is that true? Let me ask. Takes a lot more energy than just accepting it as true. And if it fits with how the world works, then why? Just don't even bother, right? The second reason is that when it appeals to our emotions, when it triggers us, I should say, emotionally, especially anger, fear, outrage. Honestly, even satire works in part because it appeals to some of our emotions. It makes us laugh and it confirms how we think the world works. And then the third is when we hear it repeated. So our brain assumes ease of processing with truth. And so this is really a danger if you're in an echo chamber with other people who are sharing the same kinds of misinformation. So knowing what your biases are, your emotional triggers, practicing emotional skepticism Like, you know what? This really made me angry. I should probably stop and ask about that. You won't check if something is true. You won't even question if it's true. If you don't have that part of your brain turned on and ready to go. So we need to know why we're vulnerable and be like, no one else is going to take this responsibility for us. We have to do it for ourselves. Talking to others is a whole nother level. Did you want to go there?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So I will say, I will admit to being a bit of a hypocrite here, because there have been people in my family that I have had to cut out of my life.
Same here.
From my own mental health, my own sanity, and everybody needs to have their own boundaries. And yeah, you got to do what you got to do for you. Mm-hmm. But the more people are cut off from reliable sources of information or the other, then the more they retreat to other people who already believe the same thing that they do, and the more we risk the chance of losing them. So if you are willing to maintain that connection, start with... So one of my favorite things to help my students understand how their brain works and having conversations with others is the elephant and the rider analogy. Have you heard this?
No, please tell us.
So this is Jonathan Haidt's analogy, and I actually think it has Buddhist origins. But the idea is, imagine in your head, there's an elephant and then a rider on top of the elephant. So the rider is your part of your brain that you think of as you. It's the part that can think critically and can, you know, evaluate evidence and, right. But the rider's on top of an elephant, and that elephant is big and it's powerful. It's really hard to control an elephant. The elephant is the part of the brain that is, it's always on, it's always doing its thing, and it's motivated by its emotions, its biases, its self-interests, its assumptions, its instincts. And so often what happens is, like, we think, presented with new information, you know, our writer thinks through this and then comes to the best possible conclusion. Actually, what happens is the elephant jumps to a conclusion based on those other things, like its emotions and assumptions, etc. It jumps to a conclusion, and then the writer goes, yeah, that sounds about right. Sure. Oh, no. Right. So it doesn't even question, doesn't think to question. The elephant just suggests something to it, and the writer goes, yeah, okay. And then if asked, our writer acts more like the PR department or the lawyer for the elephant that goes, well, here are all the reasons why my elephant is right. So, and unfortunately, there are some studies that show that the more educated we are and the more intelligent we are, the better our writer is at justifying what the elephant already wants to believe, right? Mm-hmm. So that alone is not protective. We have to be willing to, the lesson here is to pay attention to what the elephant is doing. This is basic metacognition, understanding your own thinking, asking yourself, do I have an emotional attachment to this? Is there some reason that I want to believe or I don't want to believe? Am I emotionally triggered? Or is this playing to my biases, right? So being aware of where that potentially might come from. But one step further. So I have a rider and an elephant, right? If I'm talking to you, I think that my rider is talking to your rider. But there's actually four people in this conversation. And really, it's an elephant conversation that our riders just try and dress up in something that seems like logic. So I need to know about my own thought processes. But then if I want to connect with you, it looks like you're giving me facts and evidence, and it looks like a rational argument. But all of that could be coming from the elephant trying to help the writer find those justifications. So dig past that surface level of facts, what seems like facts, and go down to the elephant. That's where you connect with people and go, you know what? I know you want what's best for your kids. I do too. Like, that vaccine, when it first came out, it seemed really fast. I was a little scared too, if I admit it. So I knew that though, and I tried to figure out what would be the best decision for my family. Connect at that emotional level, the things that you have in common.
Beautiful. Wow. Yes. And pardon me, you mentioned the emotions, especially anger and fear, and not just anger, but outrage. And that is something that, again, the demographic that I work with, a lot of fundamentalist religious groups and beliefs have to do with fear. And because it's so strong. And so then people are making decisions out of fear. And that's never a great place. It's hard to be logical. Fear eats logic for breakfast. So it makes it very hard to make good decisions when we're feeling afraid. And then now also something that I see on social media, particularly with cancel culture, people are afraid even to speak out. So someone might be, you know, rage farming some kind of idea, just putting it out there, this. And then if someone says, well, wait a minute, I'm not sure about that. Let's dig a little bit deeper. We don't even have the chance to do that because all the people rushing to the defense of the rage farmer or whatever it is come clamoring down on top of us for having a question. And this wasn't the same issue prior to social media. So those of us who grew up before the age of social media, we're the ones that are more likely, I think, a lot of times to be asking the questions. But people can wield social media like a club to try and beat others into submission and into falling into line with the views that seem important to them. It's definitely the elephant is in charge there. And that can be a really uncomfortable position for people to be in. And we can't change other people's minds. We can't make people do or think or be anything else. All we can do is present the evidence in a humble manner, recognizing that we can be mistaken as well.
Yeah, there was a lot there. A couple of things. Social media, you're right, is both a blessing and a curse. Like, there are good parts about it, and there's also bad parts about it. If you have run into someone, especially someone that you know personally, actually, let me turn this around. Imagine that you have posted something, and someone disagrees with you, and they enter the comments, and they tell you why you're wrong. Now, we are more motivated to defend our beliefs when they're tied to our identity. But back to, we've signaled now in this case, we've put out to the public that this is what I believe. And now we're being challenged on that in public. So instead of calling people out, I would suggest that people consider calling people in that, one of the ways this looks like for me, instead of putting it in the comments, message them privately and say, you know what, I see you posted this and I just like to, you know, enter this conversation with you. If it's okay with you, I would like to tell you maybe why I think you might be want to consider this. Have that conversation privately and you're going to stand a much better chance of changing their mind. But there is the bystander effect. There are people watching this conversation that might learn. So if you, in certain circumstances, if you are trying to call someone, trying to challenge something on what they've posted, it might be better for you to put it in the comments, phrased obviously kindly, not aggressively. But in that case, your goal is not them as much as it is the people watching the conversation.
Yeah, curiosity opens doors, fear closes doors. And so if someone is if we feel like someone's attacking us, we're more likely to close the door. So that's where I'm thinking of the response that we might have. Let's be led by our curiosity. I remember memorizing a poem, I think when I was in grade 8, too bad I can't remember the author, but it was about, he drew a circle that shut me out, heretic rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that drew him in. Isn't that beautiful?
Oh my God, that's beautiful.
it's so profound. I'll have to Google when we're done. I thought it was from a book, maybe Light a Single Candle, but I'll try and find out the author of it. But that sounds very much in line with what you're saying of how to respond to people that have questions and even how we can question. And it's hard, boy, oh boy, when your ire is up, when you're feeling irritated and outraged and angry, which seems to be a common feeling that a lot of us are living our day-to-day lives this way right now, we have to be extra measured in how we respond. And this goes for me too. I post a lot on social media, and sometimes people will come into my comments, and I mean, it's the lowest hanging fruit. They'll make a comment on my the way that I look, rather than anything that actually is an argument about what I was talking about.
Oh yeah, I've been there.
Yeah, it just happens, and it's so, I find it so bizarre, because I just don't operate that way. That's not the way that I was raised, and it's not the way, I just don't comment on how people look. I'm interested in the content of their information, you know, what they're posting about. And so, you know, sometimes people are just, that's the way they are. That's the level they're going to be, approaching other people at. And I can't do anything about it. I don't have to engage with those people. Sometimes I will say, you know, I'm curious as to why your response would be related to my physical appearance rather than the information that I've posted. Do you want to talk about it? But I don't always have the emotional bandwidth to deal with those sorts of things. So like you mentioned earlier, I need to protect myself. And sometimes that's what the mute button is for, or the block button. But then, yeah, other people are missing out on the opportunity to see how we would respond to those folks. But you have to take care of yourself. Oh, you're muted.
Sorry. The ad hominem fallacy is when somebody attacks the arguer as opposed to the argument. And it's generally a sign of a lack of a good argument. So I would take that as a win, actually. Like, they don't actually have substantive response to what I've said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they're just going to attack my appearance instead. Be like, you know what? If you had something better, you would have given it to me, but you didn't. So.
Right. Yes. Wow. And it's all tied in, of course, these days with our politics as well. And I'm in Canada, and you're, I think, in the United States. And I mean, you guys sneeze and we catch cold over here. Whatever's going on over there is going to go on over here eventually, and is often happening over here on a smaller scale anyway. I recognize that this is a particularly exhausting time in history that we are living through, as we're having to combat not only disinformation, but also then the egos that get caught up as the ideology and identity become enmeshed with each other. And then you and I already talked a little bit about, you know, sometimes you have to close that door for your own safety, your own mental health. If you can keep it open, you know, just being kind and curious, asking questions and allowing them to respectfully ask questions with us. It's okay to insist that things remain respectful and polite, even with people that we're close to. if not especially with those people. And you never know, one day down the road, that person, the light might actually come on for them, and you might be the only person that they feel safe to come to and say, oh, I don't actually believe this anymore, but now I've said so much publicly, or I've converted other people to my belief system, and I don't know what to do about it. So we can sometimes be the person, the safe person for them.
Yeah, if I might tell one of my favorite stories in social psychology, that I give a presentation on why facts don't change our minds. And I use this story to illustrate the point. So in 1954, there was a woman named Dorothy Martin outside of Chicago. She was a housewife and a psychic. And her medium was automatic handwriting. And one day she woke up and she was receiving a message from Sananda, who is Jesus living on the planet Clarion. And Sananda, or Jesus, told Dorothy to gather other seekers to hear the messages from the guardians. And so she did, and a group formed around her. One day over the summer, she got a message that the world was going to be destroyed in a global flood on December 21st that year. And a psychologist named Leon Festinger, who is probably one of the most important psychologists of the 20th century, was reading his morning paper over his coffee and saw this in the newspaper and thought, I wonder what will happen on December 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
The world didn't end, right? So he had his fellow psychologists infiltrate the group over the next several months to see what happened. And the result is his book called When Prophecy Fails, and it's absolutely brilliant. But over the course of the next several months, you see the group become more and more insular. Like, so they thought the world was going to end, right? In a flood, and the aliens were going to come in their flying saucer and save them. And the followers, some of them gave up their jobs, all of their money, they lost their kids. I mean, why would they need those things? The world was going to end, right? So, and everyone was mocking them. And so they went to live with her. They were waiting for the end of the world when they were finally going to be vindicated and saved. And so, you know, series of false starts. But on December, you know, 21st, 22nd, when the world didn't end, they couldn't. He actually describes a situation of them trying to understand what's happening. Like, the midnight passes and there's no aliens. And they're like, well, the clock is wrong. Okay. A few minutes later, well, there's a delay. And then like 2 hours later, well, we're told to take a coffee break. And then by 4:30 in the morning, there's no aliens. And I mean, can you imagine? They've given up everything. They've been mocked. The world was going to end in a flood. They couldn't possibly be wrong. So at 4:30, Dorothy got a message that the world was not going to be flooded because their devotion and belief had saved the world.
Mm-hmm.
So not only were they not wrong, they were so right. They saved the entire planet and everyone living on it. You are welcome, right? This is when they go out and start proselytizing, because they hadn't before. But over the pandemic, I kept seeing QAnon predictions that didn't come true, or various conspiratorial, like, you know, everybody who got a vaccine is going to die in 6 months, and then they don't. And then there was the 5G stuff and the microchips. And I kept thinking, the aliens aren't coming. Are they going to accept the fact that there was not going to be a flood and no aliens? Or how are they going to justify this to themselves? And there was always a justification. Because when we have been that wrong publicly and staked our reputation on it and been mocked for it, the being wrong is too hard. It's too much. There are people who die of COVID still not believing in the existence of COVID. And from the outside, that looks completely illogical. Like, how in the world can you still not admit it? Brooke Harrington, the social psychologist, said something to the effect of, if there is an E equals MC squared of social psychology, it's that social death is worse than physical death.
Wow.
We would rather not lose our social standing, right? That is too painful. So we have to be careful when people become isolated and mocked for these beliefs and they lose the kinds of safe places they might otherwise be able to go to have those kinds of connections and not only be okay to be wrong, but see other people admitting, like, you know what? I don't know. Oh, wow. I was wrong. That's awesome. I just learned something. You know, we need to model that. We need to be okay with being wrong, right? But we need to allow others to be wrong, not use that as an opportunity to dunk on them. But that's something to be commended.
Beautiful. That is so true. Yes, I tell my clients that I welcome regrets because even though they might sting a little, they're evidence of my growth. I don't think the same way that I thought when I did that thing. I kind of wish I hadn't done. And so, yeah, it can feel, kind of embarrassing, but mainly, hey, it's a marker of my growth. And so I need to be compassionate with myself in that instance. And I also need to show compassion for others who have regrets because they have made some whopper mistakes. You know, it's that old thing. When we know better, we do better. There's some truth to that. This has been such a delightful and interesting conversation with you, Melanie. How can people find you?
So my website, Thinking is Power, has a mini course in critical thinking, information literacy, and science literacy. So please come there and check that out. If you're an educator, there's a page for educators with assignments and so on. I'm on Facebook. It's my biggest social media site. I try to post something at least once a day. I'm trying the other social platforms as well, and a YouTube channel. So I'd really appreciate the love on those kinds of channels. And all of my social platforms are at Thinking Powers.
Beautiful. Wow. Terrific. Melanie Treset King. It's just been such a pleasure. I hope that we get to talk again. I'd love to have you speak at the conference on religious trauma. And so you and I can discuss that.
I would love that. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks everyone for tuning in. Please take care. We'll see you again soon.